Such, then, was Joseph's device. It so came about that midday of that very day found Jacob sitting under the awning on the field, after he had inspected the grain pits and the threshing floor, and tested with his thumb the sharpness of the little wheels. The ten were amazed. For the last few days the dreamer had not shared their noontide rest. Now he was here again, with his head in his father's lap. Naturally he ought to be here if the father was. But what was it that had brought the old man so suddenly? They sat stiff and silent, all decently covered out of respect to Jacob's views. The latter was surprised to find none of the hearty good feeling which, according to Joseph's account, reigned at the harvesting. Perhaps its absence was due to respect for the father and master. Even Joseph had not much to say. He was afraid, even though he lay in his father's lap and had the protection and the hearing for his tale which that implied. He was indeed troubled by his dream and the results which might flow from it. He could say in a sentence all there was to say. There would be nothing left. If Gad were to ask, "Is that all?" he would be a beaten man. Of course, the briefness of his tale had the advantage that it would all be out at once before anyone could stop him. But the large lines and scant ornament might be the very things which would defeat his purpose. He almost let slip his chance in the end, for they were all so bored that they were tempted to break up early. Even the signs of departure were not enough to conquer his misgivings, and perhaps nothing at all would have happened if Jacob had not helped him out by saying genially, "I hear you tell each other stories at the rest hour. Recite, and so on. Did I not?" They stared in bewilderment. "Yes, yes," Joseph cried, starting up. "Funny stories and dreams. Sometimes we are full of them. Do we know anything new?" he asked brazenly, looking round the circle. They kept on staring at him and saying nothing. "But I do," said he, and sat up on Jacob's lap with an absorbed look. "There is a dream which I dreamed last night on the threshing floor. Father and brethren, ye should hear and be amazed. I dreamed," he went on, and then stopped. There was a curious writhing of the limbs, a spasmodic lifting of the neck and shoulders, a twisting of the arms. His head drooped. The smile upon his lips seemed to deprecate and extenuate the sudden whiteness of his eyes. "I dreamed," he repeated, in a sort of gasp, "and I saw in my dream, this I saw the sun, the moon, and the 11 Kukavim waiting upon me. They came and bowed down before me." Nobody stirred. Jacob, the father, kept his eyes severely cast down. It was very still. But in the stillness came an evil, mysterious, and yet distinct sound. It was the gnashing of the brethren's teeth. Most of them kept their lips closed, but Simeon and Levi showed their teeth as they gnashed. Jacob heard the gnashing. It was hard to say whether Joseph grasped its significance. He was smiling quietly and dreamily to himself with his head on one side. It was out. Let them do what they chose about it. Sun, moon, and stars, 11 in number, had attended him. Let them look to it. Jacob looked timidly round the circle. It was as he expected. 10 pairs of eyes were fixed wildly and importunately upon him. He summoned up his powers, and sitting at the boy's back, he addressed him as harshly as he could. "Jehoseph, what sort of dream is this thou hast dreamed? And how couldst thou dream so unsavory a thing, and tell it unto us? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren come and worship thee? Thy mother is dead, and therewith beginneth the crack-brainedness, but is far from ending it. Shame upon thee! By all human reckoning, this stuff thou hast served up to us is so preposterous that it might just as well have been nothing but aula saula la caula, and done just as much good. I am grieved in my soul that thou, with full 17 years, and despite all the enlightenment of the written word and reason which thou hast enjoyed by my permission through instruction from my servant Eliezer, hast made no greater progress in the understanding of the divine than to allow thyself to dream that which dishonoureth thee, and to play the buffoon before thy father and brethren. let this be the punishment meted out to thee. I would punish thee more severely, and perhaps pull thy hair till thou didst cry out for pain, were not thy prattle too childish for riper minds to take note of it, or the man settled in years be tempted to repay thee with great harshness. Fare thee well, sons of Leah, and greetings after the meal, sons of Zilpah and Bilhah. Saying which, he stood up behind Joseph and went hence. The reproof had cost him much to utter. He only hoped that it had satisfied the brethren. If any real anger had spoken in it, that could be only on the score that the lad had not told the dream to him alone, instead of being so mad as to make the brethren witness of the telling. Had he done it of set purpose, to cause the father embarrassment, Jacob thought, he could not have found a better device. That he would certainly tell him when they were alone, since he could not have done it now. Probably he understood how shrewdly the lad had used the brothers as protection against himself, and himself as protection against the brothers. For he even suppressed a smile in his beard as he went homewards over the cleverness of this double dealing. He certainly felt the irritation he had expressed on the score of the boy's soul, as well as the anxiety over his tendency to dreams and prophetic spasms, but both anger and anxiety were swallowed up in the yearning, half-credulous satisfaction which filled him when he thought of Joseph's presumptuous dreams. Quite absurdly, he prayed God that the dream might have come from him, which was utter nonsense, seeing how highly unlikely it was that he had had anything to do with it. And tears of sheer tenderness came into his eyes at the thought that his son's innocent prattle might represent, though vaguely and uncomprehendingly, actual premonitions of future greatness. Ah, poor, weak father heart! He might well have been angry to hear that he and the brethren would come to bow down before the good-for-nothing. That was perplexing for him to hear, for did he not adore him? As for the brethren, hardly was Jacob gone than they flung as one man into the open, but after a few paces out into the meadow stood still together and took stormy counsel. Big Reuben spoke. He told them what was to be done. Away! That was the thing. Unanimous departure from the paternal hearth. Voluntary banishment. That, Reuben said, would be dignified and impressive behavior, and the only possible answer to such detestable treatment. Away from Joseph! Was what he had in mind, in order that no disaster might befall the lad. Of course he did not express his feelings, but put his advice entirely in the light of a reproach and a protest. That very evening they came before Jacob, and told him they were going, a place where such dreams were told, without other risk than at worst of getting one's hair pulled, was no place for them. They had nothing to lose by leaving it. They had helped mightily with the harvesting. Now they would go to Shechem, not only the six, but also the four, in fact all ten, for the meadows of Shechem were fat and fertile, and there, in unchanged, if also in unrewarded loyalty, they would pasture their father's flocks, and the camp at Hebron would know them no more, now that it was become a place of such high dreaming. They made obeisance and bowed down, they said, suiting the action to the words, in taking reverent leave of their father and lord. They needed not to fear that their going would give him pain, since it was well known that Jacob would give 10 for 1. Jacob bowed his head. Did he begin to fear lest the ascendancy of the emotions which, basing on an exalted model, he permitted himself, was being taken amiss in the high place of its origin? Chapter 5. The Journey to the Brothers. The Challenge. We have been told how Jacob bowed his head when he heard the embittered brethren announce their departure from his hearth. From then on he lifted it but seldom. It was now the season of parching heat. At no other time in the year did the sun's rays so cruelly scorch the land, for the moment of its waning was at hand. This was the solstice, the season in which the true wife had presented Joseph to Jacob, in the month of Tammuz. Yet even so, Jacob's spirit was wont to suffer beneath the blackened desolation of this quarter of the circle. That he suffered now might be explained in the same way. But no, the true ground of his depression was the unanimous departure of his sons. I should be saying too much if I asserted that this had given Jacob great pain. In his heart he truly did give 10 for 1. Yet it was quite another matter to reckon with the objective fact, to realize that the brother's notice to quit was decisive, and that he, Jacob, would be left with 2 sons instead of 12, a tree lopped of its branches. It was a blow to his dignity, first of all, but also it put him in an embarrassing position before his God, and he inquired of himself how much these actions of his went counter to the plans of the Lord of the promise, and how great was the accounting he had invited upon his own head. For he that ruled future things, had he not taken care that not all matters should go after Jacob's heart, and he be fruitful in Rachel alone? Yes, he had made him fruitful against his own will, and even those unwanted sons from the unloved wife were themselves the fruit of the blessing and bearers of destinies unknown. Jacob was well aware that his elevation of Joseph was a piece of arbitrary self-indulgence, which might easily come to clash with the vast designs of God, and so reveal itself as culpable presumption. Indeed, it seemed already to have done so, for though Joseph's folly may have been the immediate occasion of the catastrophe, and though Jacob had suffered in chiding him, yet the father well knew who it was who must pay for this folly, before God and man. In contending with Joseph, he contended with himself. The boy had been the only medium of whatever mischief had been done. The real culprit was Jacob's own loving heart. It did not avail to hide it from himself, for God knew it, and one hid not himself before God. For the truth was, therein lay the inheritance of Abraham. It meant no more than that one did not give false evidence in matters known to God. Such were the mental struggles in the time after the grain harvest, which slowly shaped Jacob's decisions. He had conceived evil in his heart. Now, that heart must conquer its weakness by seeing to it that the spoilt darling who had been the medium of the harm should also be the medium of the healing. He would treat the lad with a little severity, would lay a responsibility upon him by way of doing penance himself. Seeing him at a distance, he summoned him rather peremptorily. "Joseph!" "Here am I," answered the boy, and was beside him at once. He was glad to be called, for since the departure of the brothers, his father had spoken to him but little. Besides, that last meeting with the brethren had left him, even in his folly, with a feeling of discomfortable anxiety. "Hearken," said Jacob. Some obscure motive made him feign absent-mindedness. He blinked repeatedly and drew his beard through his hand.
"Tell me if I am right in thinking that thy elder brothers are grazing the sheep together in the vale of Shechem?"
"Yes, of a surety," responded Joseph. "For it seemeth to me, too, if my memory erreth not, they desired to go together to Shechem to tend thy flocks, on account of the fat meadows there, and because this valley will not hold all of thine."
"So it is," confirmed Jacob. "And it is for this reason that I called thee, for I hear naught of the sons of Leah, and of the sons of the maids all knowledge is hidden from me. It is not known to me how it standeth in the meadows of Shechem, whether Yitzchak's blessing was upon the summer lambing, or whether my herds are afflicted with swelling and with liver fluke. For my children, thy brothers, I know naught of them, nor hear whether they exercise our pasture rights in peace, in that district where, as I mind me, serious things once came to pass. It giveth me to think, and in such thoughts I resolve to send thee to them to greet them from me."
"Here am I!" cried Joseph again.
He flashed his white teeth at his father, hopped up and down, and stamped with his heels, on fire to be off.
"When I consider," went on Jacob, "that thou enterest into the 18th year of thy age, methinks it is time to put thy manhood to some sterner test than thou hast known, and therefore I am resolved to stir thee up to this mission, that thou leavest me for thy brothers for some short space, to inquire of them concerning all that of which I am ignorant,
and to return to me with God's help after 10 or 9 days, and tell me what thou hast learned."
"Verily, here am I," cried Joseph again, enraptured with the idea. "My father's words are golden and silver. I will make a journey across the land. I will visit the brethren, and look after things in the vale of Shechem, and all that will be the greatest pleasure. Could I have wished for my heart's desire, it would not have been other than this."
Jacob said, "Thou dost not go to look after things. Thy brethren are men enough to do that themselves, and need not a child. Moreover, it is not the sense in which I send thee. Rather shalt thou bow before them with all seemliness and the forms of courtesy, and speak thus: I am come some day's journey to greet you and ask after your well-being, from my own desire as well as at my father's bidding, for our wishes in this matter are one.
Give me Parash to ride. He is long-legged and hard, very strong-boned, and like to my brother Issachar."
"It speaketh for thy manliness," answered Jacob after a pause, "that thou rejoicest over thy mission, and regardest it not as strange to go away from me for a number of days, so that the moon shall change from a sickle to a half round before I see thee again. But say to thy brethren, the Father willed it."
"Shall I have Parash?"
"I am indeed minded not to deal with thee softly, but according to thy age. Yet the ass Parash I will not give thee, for he is bulky, and his intelligence doth not keep pace with his fire. A much better choice is white Huldah, a friendly and careful beast, also smart to look at. When thou journeyest abroad, thou shalt ride her. But that thou mayest know that I expect somewhat of thee, and that the brothers may know it too, it is my command that thou makest the journey alone, from here to the meadows of Shechem. For I will give thee no servant along with thee, nor let Eliezer ride at thy side. Thou shalt travel independently, and shalt tell the brethren, 'Alone I come, upon a white ass, to visit you according to our father's will.' Then may it be that thou needest not to ride back alone, but that the brethren may journey with thee, some or all. At least, such is my second purpose in this order."
"That I will contrive," promised Joseph. "I make myself bail to bring them back to thee. Indeed, I will be guarantee, therefore, and say to thee, I come not again, unless to bring them to thee."
Thus Joseph pranced about his father, prattling away heedlessly, and giving praise to Yah that he was to travel by himself and see the world. He ran off to Benjamin and to Eliezer, the old man, to tell them all. Jacob, looking after him, nodded his head, for he perceived that if one could speak of a challenge, it was directed toward himself and nobody else. But was he not doing rightly, and acting as his inward responsibility for Joseph bade him act? He would not see the lad for several days. It seemed to him sufficient penance, and he refused to speculate as to what the upper spheres would have considered due severity. He reckoned with a failure of Joseph's mission, that is, he realized that the latter might return without the brethren. That they might return without him was so frightful a thought that his conscious mind did not even deal with the possibility. But since things always turn out otherwise than as one had thought, we might forestall destiny by our fears and apprehensions as with an exorcism. And therefore fate paralyzes our imagination, that it may deal its crushing blows unhampered by our preventive spells. The needful preparations for Joseph's journey put Jacob in mind of his own past, and of that fateful day when Rebekah got him ready, and he left after the transfer of the blessing which he had conceived and carried through. And his soul was full of the solemn emotions of recurrence. Certainly the comparison was far-fetched enough, for his was by no means the heroic part which Rebekah had played when she deliberately sacrificed her own heart, assumed responsibility for the rectifying deceit, and then, fully conscious that she would probably never see him again, sent away the beloved son into a strange land. The theme admitted of some variations. True, Joseph, too, was leaving home on account of his outraged brethren's wrath. Yet he was not flying from the wrath. Jacob was sending him, as it were, into Esau's arms. It was the scene by Jabbok Ford which Jacob had in mind, and whose recurrence he was so eager to bring about. The outward humiliation, the outward reconciliation which was inwardly so full of reservations, the smoothing over of obvious discords, the achievement of apparent harmony. How different from all that was Rebekah's resolute assumption of the guilt. Jacob's aim in sending Joseph was the impossible one of putting things back where they were. But since it was already plain that that could not be done, the result would simply be a resumption of the game, in which the pieces were Jacob's weakness, Joseph's blind conceit, and the brother's deadly grudge, and which would have led, in all probability, to the same result.